I can honestly say, hand on heart, that experimenting on a frog's leg has never helped me in any way treat a patient.
Hi there, this is Carla Owen, Chief Executive of Animal Free Research UK, and this is the Animal Free Labcast, the show dedicated to a kinder, modern science that puts humans at the heart of medical research. Today I'm talking with Martin Ashby, a doctor working in palliative medicine for the NHS and a trustee of Animal Free Research UK. I'll be asking Martin about his motivation for supporting animal replacement research and how he gained confidence as a young medical student to challenge the status quo. We had a slight technical glitch with the recording, so the audio is a little bit less optimal than usual, but please do stay tuned to learn about Martin's work, how the launch of Channel 4 switched him and a new generation onto speaking out for animals, and what needs to happen to find better treatments for patients. So I'm absolutely delighted to be joined on the Animal Free Labcast today with Dr. Martin Ashby. Martin, welcome. Could you start off by just telling us a little bit about yourself, what you do and how you're involved?
Yeah, thanks. So I've been a doctor for about 30 years in lots of different fields, really. Mm. I started off doing a bit of psychiatry and some medicine and then trained as a GP. Did that for a couple of years and then worked as a GP for the homeless, mm-hmm. Which sort of took me into the field of alcohol and drug detoxification.
Sure.
And then from there, I moved on to doing palliative medicine. Mm-hmm. So for the past, I'd say about 14 years, I've been a consultant in the NHS working in palliative medicine.
And how does that kind of bring you to animal-free research? What's your interest and your kind of motivation for that?
I suppose that's a bit of a story. So I'm 54. I'm 54, so I'm old enough to remember the first night that Channel 4 started, which was right. In the early 80s.
Yeah.
And when Channel 4 started, they were going to be a new sort of more radical channel than the other three.
Yeah.
And one of their remits was to question things that other channels hadn't. Mm. So on the first night they broadcast, they showed a film called The Animals Film, mm-hmm. which was a film all about animal exploitation and how our society exploits animals. So it covered things like factory farming, animal experiments, fox hunting, fur farming, etc. And for me, it was quite shocking to find out how we treat animals and how a lot of this is hidden from the public.
Yeah.
So that sort of spurred my interest in.
I've heard a lot of people talking about that and
have you?
And watching it.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit too young for it.
Yeah.
Lots of people I know. That was a real changing
right.
point for them, a real turning point.
So for me, I became vegetarian sort of overnight, which
yeah.
even in the early 80s was quite unusual.
Yeah.
Although my dad had been vegetarian from the 50s, which was really
oh, wow.
unusual. So
yeah.
I knew a bit about it. And I remember joining the Vegetarian Society, mm-hmm. and in there were some adverts from the BUAV, which is an anti-vivisection group, and I wrote away and got some information and started finding out more about animal experiments.
And
I guess for me that brought up a conflict, because I always knew I wanted to be a doctor, I wanted to be involved in medicine, advancing research and care for patients.
And how old were you then, Martin? Like, where were you in your career stage at that point?
Probably about 17, so
okay.
I was doing my A-levels.
Yeah.
So I knew about the ethical arguments,
but
I was a bit conflicted because at that time I thought that animal experiments were how we advance science.
Yeah.
So that created a bit of a dilemma for me. Yeah. Mm. But then I came across a book written by someone called Dr. Robert Sharp, who was a senior research chemist at the Royal Postgraduate Medical School. And he wrote a book called The Cruel Deception. Mm-hmm. So he works in a research lab where other colleagues were using animals. And he started to question how effective that was and started to realise the problems associated with that. And I read his book from cover to cover in about 2 days. And basically, it talked about all the failures of animal research, how misleading it was, how it could waste resources, and how it's probably held back a lot of progress for us. Yeah. So that was a huge relief to me that there were actually questions surrounding the use of animals. Then I went to university and I found out about a group called Doctors in Britain Against Animal Experiments, and I joined those.
Yeah.
And they focus very much around the scientific argument against animal experiments.
Yeah.
And so that sort of spurred me on and gave me the confidence to start questioning things and not accepting everything at face value. And you have to remember that medicine, and I think research as well, is quite conservative.
Yeah.
And quite often you're sort of drawn into fitting in with the mould and not questioning things. And that gave me a dilemma because I was questioning things and I was being a bit different.
And so what was that like at university in the mid to late 80s?
Yeah, it was difficult, but in the late 80s there was a growing movement of people questioning politics, the economy, society. I think there was a growing acceptance that not everything in society is how we want it, and that you can start being more open about questioning parts of society, parts of your work, and parts of research. I remember in my first year at university, we were allocated to physiology groups, and one of the first experiments that we were involved with was actually experimenting on frogs' legs. And that was an experiment where the frogs had been killed and we went into the lab and there was a frog's leg there on your station. And we had to dissect the nerve out and perform various experiments on it. And during this experiment, I was horrified to discover that there was a black plastic dustbin full of live frogs in water that this physiology technician was sort of taking out and what's called pithing the frogs, which is where she put a knitting needle through their brain in order to kill them for the experiment. So, I mean, that caused me a lot of distress and trauma.
Sure.
And I thought, I can't go on to the next module, which was on a rabbit's heart. So myself and a few other people in the medical school refused to take part in the next experiment, which was a problem because we were told if we didn't take part in it, then we wouldn't pass our physiology module, which meant that we wouldn't pass our first year of medical school.
Yeah, which presumably then means you don't get to become a doctor.
Exactly. Yeah. But enough of us complained about it that they removed the module.
Oh, fantastic.
And I'm pleased to say that the medical school I went to, UCL in London, doesn't use animals in its undergraduate medical courses now.
Great progress then.
Absolutely. And I can honestly say, hand on heart, that experimenting on a frog's leg has never helped me in any way treat a patient.
No. And has also stayed with you because, you know, however many years on, that's the thing that you still remember. That's kind of where it all started.
Yeah, and taught me that sometimes you have to sort of stand up for things.
Yeah.
Which isn't always easy.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how was that? How was the kind of standing up and taking a stand in a conservative sort of environment?
Yeah, it was difficult. You find your own, I think I found my own group of people at medical school. We weren't necessarily all vegetarian or anti-vivisection, but we're just a bit different to the rest. Yeah. Medical students can be quite like doctors and researchers can be quite conservative. I think a lot of that is fear, wanting to fit in, wanting to be like other people. And we're all like that to an extent. You don't like being an outsider, but sometimes that is the right path to take.
Well, and I guess, you know, when you go to university, you're learning, especially when you're learning a profession, you're learning how to be in that profession. You're learning the language of it and the working practices and the culture of it. Mm-hmm. So to come into that as somebody that's new and, you know, wanting to go down that career path, and then finding that there's things about that that you want to challenge, that is difficult to do, isn't it?
Yeah, especially as a student.
Yeah.
I think once you've qualified, things get a little bit easier, but then you've got the sort of junior doctor training that you have to go through to become a GP or a consultant. And again, you know, you have to fit in to a certain degree.
Yeah. So did you find later on in your career that the issue of using animals came up again, or was it sort of dealt with at that point, that kind of quite early stage, and didn't come up and confront you?
Not directly in my career, but the field I work in palliative medicine, a lot of my job is dealing with pain, treating patients with pain.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll go to conferences where people will present animal models.
Mm.
For example, a lot of the patients I see have got cancer, which can spread to the bones, and that's can cause pain that's particularly difficult to treat.
Yeah.
And I'm always amazed at how patients respond to one drug, but not to another, and then another patient will respond to the different drug, but not the drug that the other patient responded to. Mm. There's such a variation in response between people. So going to conferences where someone's created an artificial model of bone cancer in a mouse by breaking part of its bone, I just look at it and think, this is absolutely ridiculous. How, you know, patients respond differently within the same species who've got the same disease.
Sure.
And we're sitting here trying to take seriously that actually a model like that is going to progress our specialty. And of course it doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
And a lot, but you know, one of the big drugs that we used to use called rofecoxib, which was an anti-inflammatory that came on the market in the 90s and was promoted because it didn't irritate the stomach lining like a lot of anti-inflammatories do, was actually withdrawn from the market a couple of years after it came onto the market because we realised it gave people heart attacks. So again, relying on those animal models wasn't the best thing for my patients.
Yeah. You're listening to the Animal Free Labcast with me, Carla Owen, Chief Executive of Animal Free Research UK, and Dr. Martin Ashby. If you're enjoying this episode, please do review and share with your friends to help us spread the word. So what do you do at these conferences then, Martin, when you can see this research, which you know, clearly don't think is benefiting your patients?
It depends what mood I'm in, if I'm honest. Sometimes I will put my hand up and say something along the lines of, I'm a bit worried that we're using these models and interpreting them to use, you know, to treat humans when we know there's such a diversity in humans.
Mm.
And often I'm met with a bit of a silence,
yeah.
An awkward silence. And then a lot of the time I talk to people on a one-to-one basis at the conference and say, you know, what did you think of that model? And I might go up to the presenter and say, you know, just tell them my concerns. I think over the years I've gone from being involved in protests and boycotts and other sort of protests that, you know, at the time were good and had their place, maybe for supporting boycotts for, you know, animal testing for cosmetics or household products.
Mm.
But actually trying to change scientists' mind and, you know, farmers' mind about what the best way is forward, I think you have to approach it in a very different way.
So what have you found is the most effective, Martin?
Well, I think a lot of the work that Animal Free Research UK is doing is brilliant. You know, we fund innovative research, which showcases and evidences our arguments.
Mm.
But we have to work with researchers because we're never going to change things by only working within our own little clique of people that don't think that animal research is scientific. We've got to work with those researchers, and sadly researchers that use animals in order to change them. And you know, one of the things I was really proud of was the helpathon that we started working with, which is, you know, for people that don't know, it's where we invite scientists who are open to change to look at their work and support them in ways to change their work, to stop using animals. A lot of these people want to stop using animals. Yeah. And, you know, I was really heartened going to our conference last year and just speaking to lots of students who all tell me that they and their colleagues and their peers want to stop using animals, but they don't know how to go about it.
Absolutely.
And that's who we have to work with.
Mm. Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. So what are some of the other kind of practical ways that you've got involved? I mean, obviously, you're involved in Animal Free Research UK. I don't think we've said so far that you're a trustee. You're on the board of trustees. So.
Yes. So, yeah, I've been a trustee for a year. As I say, I was involved in the group Doctors in Britain Against Animal Experiments. And I've been involved in a few other groups that have really focused on the scientific argument against animal research. The ethical argument's there, and I think it's something that often brings you into the movement, for want of a better word, but on its own, sadly, it's not going to be enough to change things.
Well, it hasn't, has it? Sadly.
No.
And it's what brought me in as well, but it hasn't been enough.
Yeah. So I guess for me, the other parts that are important are politics, working with politicians. That can be directly through organizations like Animal Free Research, but also personal actions. So for me, joining a political party, I think a lot of people in the animal movement, I keep telling people, you need to join a political party. You can work within the parties and change things.
Yeah.
You know, there's, I belong to my local, I live in Brighton, my local MP is a Labour MP. I joined the local Labour Party. And what occurred to me is that every 4 years, my Labour MP writes to me and says, will you support me in the ballot to stand again to be the MP? Mm-hmm. And I can write to him and say, I'm a bit concerned about your stance on X, Y, and Z, including animal experiments. And realising how much more powerful that is than just a constituent out of maybe 30,000 people is, that I'm one of 500 people actually selecting you at the next election.
So joining the party so that you can influence who is going to be the MP and representing. And obviously we should say that there are other political parties out there.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm not saying just join the party who your MP is, because sometimes that might go against a lot of your your values. But, you know, also there are groups within political parties that campaign for change. So in the Labour Party, there's the Labour Animal Welfare Society. You know, there's other groups within parties.
Yeah, the Conservative Party have one as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that group in the Conservative Party has been really influential.
Oh, it really has done a lot of good work.
Yeah.
So what do you think, kind of looking to the future then, how might things kind of pan out, and what are your hopes for your patients? What would be the thing that benefits them the most?
So I think we need a radical change in research and medicine. I think we do waste a lot of resource on animal experiments, and I don't think people are deliberately wasting their time or their money. No. I think that I go back to the conservative angle. People might not necessarily question what they're doing.
Yeah.
I think that we need to provide more resources for non-animal research, but I also think there needs to be a focus. We need to have a deadline, as it were, you know, whether it's 2030 or 2040, whereby the government commits to phasing out the use of animal experiments in medical research. And certainly in America, the FDA have committed to certain deadlines, and the Dutch government as well has also committed to deadlines. And I think once you have deadlines in place, things move a lot quicker.
And we've sort of seen that sort of working in the environmental movement, haven't we? I mean, it's not, there's always problems, of course.
Absolutely.
But it has kind of brought a point of focus to what needs to happen by when.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say, you know, the growth in renewable energy in the UK.
Yeah.
You know, we now produce 40% of our electricity by renewables. Well, 30 years ago, people were saying it could never be done.
Yeah.
But once you get a target there, it galvanizes. It galvanizes change and action.
And we saw that in cosmetics as well. Once the cosmetics industry knew that the bans were coming in, and in a phased kind of way, they put lots of money into developing the alternatives they needed in order to do that testing.
Yeah.
So going back to your day-to-day work, Martin, how is the current way that medical research is being conducted using animals impacting your patients?
Well, not all medical research is done on animals. So, you know, there is progress in areas, but there's huge areas of medical research where virtually no progress has been made, despite all the money that's been spent. So one of the big group of patients I work with are patients with long-term progressive neurological conditions. So I'll be talking about things like motor neuron disease or Parkinson's disease. And in those areas, there's been virtually zero progress. I mean, the main drug used for Parkinson's disease, L-DOPA, has been around for about 60, 70 years, and it's still the first-line drug. There were another group of drugs called dopamine agonists that came out, but really they're still second line drugs, and they're not really, they're not any better, and they've got all sorts of side effects that L-DOPA doesn't have. And then with motor neurone disease, there's only one drug called riluzole that has been used for a long, long time. And millions of pounds has been spent on research into motor neurone disease and treatments, and still nothing has really come up. And that's really sad.
Devastating for patients, isn't it?
Absolutely. And you know, I think more people are questioning it. There are other groups in Parkinson's disease that have broken away from sort of the bigger groups of patients that are questioning why is progress not being made. And I know that's something that, you know, we at Animal Free Research are working on, is actually looking at Parkinson's disease. So I think that's really important.
And if, you know, presumably, if I was to ask you what do you think could change that, then you're going to say we need human relevant research.
Yeah. And one of the sticking points is the journals. The journals, a lot of the research journals insisting that non-animal methods are compared against what they call the gold standard, which is animal research.
Yeah.
But animal research is not the gold standard at all. It's substandard. And that's one of the challenges we have.
So although progress is slow, and slower, I think, than it, you know, much slower than it needs to be for animals and for patients, I think things are starting to move in the right direction. We're doing some work around the challenging that reliance on animal data by journals. Are there other things that you see that, you know, could help us to accelerate along the right direction?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are things to be positive about. So, for example, the number of research papers that reference non-animal methods is increasing significantly and has done over the past few years. The number of papers that reference animal experiments hasn't gone down yet, but is plateauing. And you have to look at that in the context of a history where numbers have continually gone up. So I think that is a significant change. I think non-animal medical researchers need a community where they can support each other, and for us to help provide that infrastructure to develop that community.
Yeah, so that we can really kind of grow that base and encourage more researchers and more young researchers into doing non-animal research as the way forward. Yeah. And just thinking about what, you know, people listening can do, you know, What are the things that just everybody can do to get involved and to help to make a difference?
One of the things that struck me being a trustee is the huge potential there is for the work we can do and how sadly we're constrained by money. Yeah. So I know it sounds awful, but I think, you know, if people could donate money to us, that will be a big help.
It would be
involved in politics, like I said, and, you know, making sure that you buy your Leaping Bunny household products and personal care products.
Absolutely. Brilliant. I know these are difficult times for people, but anything that people can do to help, and there's lots of other, you know, donating through the website, and there's other ways. I always say, if you can give, then fantastic, please do. And if you can't, then please just have a look on the website and see what are the other things that you can do to get involved. Martin, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for all that you do as a doctor, but also as a trustee of Animal Free Research UK. It's been really fascinating to chat.
Thanks, Carla. It's been great.
I've spoken to many friends and colleagues over the years who have told me that watching Channel 4's Animals documentary was a pivotal moment for them. For those of us who have been lifetime advocates for animals, these really are exciting times as momentum is building for a kinder way of life, both in science and beyond. We still have a way to go, but as Martin says, we know what will make the difference, building a strong community that supports all scientists to transition to human-relevant research to find new, better treatments for patients without using animals. Well, that's all we have time for in this episode of the Animal Free Labcast. Huge thanks to Martin for joining me. In the next episode, I'll be talking with Dr. Malcolm Wilkinson, founder of biotech company Kirkstall Limited, which makes commercially available organ-on-a-chip technology. If you've been inspired by this conversation and would like to help, as Martin says, the best way to do that is by visiting animalfreeresearchuk.org and making a donation, if that's something that you can do right now. If not, you'll find loads of other ways on the website to support medical research that's helping to cure diseases faster without animal suffering. From me, Carla Owen, thanks so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please do share far and wide.